This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Empire Falls by Richard Russo, narrated by Ron McLarty. Prologue. Compared to the Whiting Mansion in town, the house Charles Beaumont Whiting built a decade after his return to Maine was modest. By every other standard of Empire Falls, where most single-family homes cost well under $75,000, his was palatial, with 5 bedrooms, 5 full baths, and a detached artist studio. C.B. Whiting had spent several formative years in Old Mexico, and the house he built, appearances be damned, was a mission-style hacienda. He even had the bricks specially textured and painted tan to resemble adobe. A damn fool house to build in central Maine, people said, though they didn't say it to him. Like all Whiting males, C.B. was a short man who disliked drawing attention to the fact, so the low-slung Spanish architecture suited him to a T. The furniture was of the sort used in model homes and trailers to give the impression of spaciousness. This optical illusion worked well enough except on those occasions when large people came to visit, and then the effect was that of a lavish dollhouse. The hacienda, as C.B. Whiting always referred to it, was built on a tract of land the family had owned for several generations. The first Whitings of Dexter County had been in the logging business, and they'd gradually acquired most of the land on both sides of the Knox River so they could keep an eye on what floated by on its way to the ocean, some 50 miles to the southeast. By the time C.B. Whiting was born, Maine had been wired for electricity, and the river, dammed below Empire Falls at Fair Haven, had lost much of its primal significance. The forestry industry had moved farther north and west, and the Whiting family had branched out into textiles and paper and clothing manufacture. Though the river was no longer required for power, part of C.B. Whiting's birthright was a vestigial belief that it was his duty to keep his eye on it. So when the time came to build his house, he selected a site just above the falls and across the iron bridge from Empire Falls, then a thriving community of men and women employed in the various mills and factories of the Whiting Empire. Once the land was cleared and his house built, C.B. would be able to see his shirt factory and his textile mill through the trees in winter, which in mid-Maine was most of the year. His paper mill was located a couple miles upstream, but its large smokestack billowed plumes of smoke, sometimes white and sometimes black, that he could see from his back patio. By moving across the river, C.B. Whiting became the first of his clan to acknowledge the virtue of establishing a distance from the people who generated their wealth. The family mansion in Empire Falls, a huge Georgian affair built early in the previous century, offered fieldstone fireplaces in every bedroom, and a formal dining room whose oak table could accommodate upwards of 30 guests beneath half a dozen glittering chandeliers that had been transported by rail from Boston. It was a house built to inspire both awe and loyalty among the Irish, Polish, and Italian immigrants who came north from Boston, and among the French Canadians who came south, all of them in search of work. The old Whiting Mansion was located right in the center of town, 1 block from the shirt factory and 2 from the textile mill, built there on purpose, if you could believe it, by Whiting men who worked 14-hour days, walked home for their noon meal, and then returned to the factory, often staying far into the night. As a boy, C.B. had enjoyed living in the Whiting Mansion. His mother complained constantly that it was old, drafty, and inconvenient to the country club, to the lake house, to the highway that led south to Boston, where she preferred to shop. But with its extensive shady grounds and its numerous oddly shaped rooms, it was a fine place to grow up in. His father, Honus Whiting, loved the place too, especially that only Whitings had ever lived there. Honus's own father, Elijah Whiting, then in his late 80s, still lived in the carriage house out back with his ill-tempered wife. Whiting men had a lot in common, including the fact that they invariably married women who made their lives a misery. C.B.'s father had fared better in this respect than most of his forebears. but still resented his wife for her low opinion of himself, of the Whiting Mansion, of Empire Falls, of the entire backward state of Maine, to which she felt herself cruelly exiled from Boston. The lovely wrought iron gates and fencing that had been brought all the way from New York to mark the perimeter of the estate were to her the walls of her prison, and every time she observed this, Honus reminded her that he held the key to those gates and would let her out at any time. If she wanted to go back to Boston so damn bad, she should just do it. He said this knowing full well she wouldn't, for it was the particular curse of the Whiting men that their wives remained loyal to them out of spite. By the time their son was born, though, Honus Whiting was beginning to understand and privately share his wife's opinion, at least as it pertained to Empire Falls. As the town mushroomed during the last half of the 19th century, the Whiting estate gradually was surrounded by the homes of mill workers, and of late, the attitude of the people doing the surrounding seemed increasingly resentful. The Whitings had traditionally attempted to appease their employees each summer by throwing gala socials on the family grounds, but it seemed to Honus Whiting that many of the people who attended these events anymore were singularly ungrateful for the free food and drink and music, some of them regarding the mansion itself with hooded expressions that suggested their hearts wouldn't be broken if it burned to the ground. Perhaps because of this unspoken but growing animosity, C.B. Whiting had been sent away, first to prep school, then to college. Afterward, he'd spent the better part of a decade traveling, first with his mother in Europe, which was much more to that good woman's liking than Maine, and then later on, his own in Mexico, which was much more to his liking than Europe, where there'd been too much to learn and appreciate. While many European men towered over him, those in Mexico were shorter, and C.B. Whiting especially admired that they were dreamers who felt no urgency about bringing their dreams to fruition. But his father, who was paying for his son's globe-trotting, finally decided his heir should return home and start contributing to the family fortune instead of squandering as much as he could south of the border. Charles Beaumont Whiting was by then in his late 20s, and his father was coming to the reluctant conclusion that his only real talent was for spending money, though the young man claimed to be painting and writing poetry as well. Time to put an end to both, at least in the old man's view. Honus Whiting was fast approaching his 60th birthday, and though glad he'd been able to indulge his son, he now realized he'd let it go on too long, and that the boy's education and the family businesses he would one day inherit was long overdue. Honus himself had begun in the shirt factory, then moved over to the textile mill, and finally, when old Elijah had lost his mind one day and tried to kill his wife with a shovel, took over the paper mill upriver. Honus wanted his son to be prepared for the inevitable day when he, too, would lose his marbles and assault Charles's mother with whatever weapon came to hand. Europe had not improved her opinion of himself, of Empire Falls, or of Maine, as he had hoped it might. In his experience, people were seldom happier for having learned what they were missing, and all Europe had done for his wife was encourage her natural inclination toward bitter and invidious comparison. For his part, Charles Beaumont Whiting, sent away from home as a boy when he would have preferred to stay, now had no more desire to return from Mexico than his mother had to return from Europe. But when summoned, he sighed and did as he was told, much as he always had done. It wasn't as if he hadn't known that the end of his youth would arrive, taking with it his travels, his painting, and his poetry. There was never any question that Whiting and Son's enterprises would one day devolve to him, and while it occurred to him that returning to Empire Falls and taking over the family businesses might be a violation of his personal destiny as an artist, there didn't seem to be any help for it. One day, when he sensed the summons growing near, he tried to put down in words what he felt to be his own best nature and how wrong it would be to thwart his true calling. His idea was to share these thoughts with his father, but what he'd written sounded a lot like his poetry, vague and unconvincing even to him, and he ended up throwing the letter away. For one thing, he wasn't sure his father, a practical man, would concede that anybody had a nature to begin with. And if you did, it was probably your duty either to deny it or to whip it into shape, show it who was boss. During his last months of freedom in Mexico, CB lay on the beach and argued the point with his father in his imagination, argued it over and over, losing every time. So when the summons finally came, he was too worn out to resist. He returned home determined to do his best, but fearing that he'd left his real self and all that he was capable of in Mexico. What he discovered was that violating his own best nature wasn't nearly as unpleasant or difficult as he'd imagined. In fact, looking around Empire Falls, he got the distinct impression that people did it every day. And if you had to violate your destiny, doing so as a whiting male wasn't so bad. To his surprise, he also discovered that it was possible to be good at what you had little interest in, just as it had been possible to be bad at something, whether painting or poetry, that you cared about a great deal. While the shirt factory held no attraction for him, he demonstrated something like an aptitude for running it, for understanding the underlying causes of what went wrong, and knowing instinctively how to fix the problem. He was also fond of his father, and marveled at the little man's energy, his quick anger, his refusal to knuckle under, his conviction that he was always right, his ability to justify whatever course of action he ultimately chose. Here was a man who was either in total harmony with his nature or had beaten it into perfect submission. Charles Beaumont Whiting was never sure which, and probably it didn't matter. Either way, the old man was worth emulating. Still, it was clear to C.B. Whiting that his father and grandfather had enjoyed the best of what Whiting and Sons Enterprises had to offer. The times were changing, and neither the shirt factory nor the textile mill nor the paper mill upriver was as profitable as all once had been. Over the last two decades, there had been attempts to unionize all the factories in Dexter County, and while these efforts failed, this being Maine, not Massachusetts, even Honus Whiting agreed that keeping the unions out had proved almost as costly as letting them in would have been. The workers, slow to accept defeat, were both sullen and unproductive when they returned to their jobs. Honus Whiting had intended, of course, for his son to take up residence in the Whiting mansion as soon as he took a wife and old Elijah saw fit to quit the earth. But a decade after C.B. abandoned Mexico, neither of these events had come to pass. C.B. Whiting, something of a ladies' man in his warm, sunny youth, seemed to lose his sex drive in frosty Maine and slipped into an unintended celibacy, though he sometimes imagined his best self still carnally frolicking in the Yucatan. Perhaps he was frightened by the sheer prospect of matrimony, of marrying a girl he would one day want to murder. Elijah Whiting, now nearing 100, had not succeeded in killing his wife with the shovel, nor had he recovered from the disappointment. The two of them still lived in the carriage house, old Elijah clinging to his misery, and his bitter wife clinging to him. He seemed, the old man's doctor observed, to be dying from within, the surest sign of which was an almost biblical flatulence. He'd been turning the air green inside the carriage house for many years now, but all the tests showed that the old fossil's heart remained strong, and Honus realized it might be several more years before he could make room for his son by moving into the carriage house himself. After all, it would require a good year to air out, even if the old man died tomorrow. Besides which, Honus's own wife had already made clear her intention never to move into the carriage house, and she lately had become so depressed by the idea of dying in Maine that he'd been forced to buy her a small row house in Boston's Back Bay, where she claimed to have grown up, which of course was untrue. South Boston was where Honus had found her, and where he would have left her too if he'd had any sense. At any rate, when Charles came to him one day and announced his intention to build a house of his own and to put the river between it and Empire Falls, he understood and even approved. Only later, when the house was revealed to be a hacienda, did he fear that the boy might be writing poems again. not to worry. Earlier that year, C.B. Whiting had been mistaken for his father on the street. And that same evening, when he studied himself in the mirror, he saw why. His hair was beginning to silver, and there was a certain terrier-like ferocity in his eyes that he hadn't noticed before. Of the younger man who had wanted to live and die in Mexico, and dream and paint and write poetry, there was now little evidence. And last spring, when his father had suggested that he run not only the shirt factory, but also the textile mill, instead of feeling trapped by the inevitability of the rest of his life, he found himself almost happy to be coming more completely into his birthright. Men had started calling him C.B. instead of Charles, and he liked the sound of it. When the bulldozers began to clear the house site, a disturbing discovery was made. An astonishing amount of trash, mounds and mounds of it, was discovered all along the bank. Some of it tangled among tree roots and branches, some of it strewn up the hillside all the way to the top. The sheer volume of the junk was astonishing, and at first C.B. Whiting concluded that somebody, or a great many somebodies, had had the effrontery to use the property as an unofficial landfill. How many years had this outrage been going on? It made him mad enough to shoot somebody, until one of the men he'd hired to clear the land pointed out that for somebody, or a great many somebodies, to use Whiting land for a dump, they would have required an access road, and there wasn't one. Or at least there hadn't been until C.B. Whiting himself cut one a month earlier. While it seemed unlikely that so much junk, spent inner tubes, hubcaps, milk cartons, rusty cans, pieces of broken furniture and the like, could wash up on one spot naturally, the result of currents and eddies, there it was, so it must have. There was little alternative but to cart the trash off, which was done the same May the foundation of the house was being poured. Spring rains, a rising river, and a bumper crop of voracious black flies delayed construction. But by late June, the low frame of the sprawling hacienda was visible from across the river, where C.B. Whiting kept tabs on its progress from his office on the top floor of the Whiting shirt factory. By the 4th of July, the weather had turned dry and hot, killing off the last of the black flies, and the shirtless, sunburned carpenters, straddling the hacienda roof beams, began to wrinkle their noses and regard one another suspiciously. What in the world was that smell? It was C.B. Whiting himself who discovered the bloated body of a large moose decomposing in the shallows, tangled among the roots of a stand of trees that had been spared by the bulldozer, that they might provide shade and privacy from anyone on the Empire Falls side of the river who might be too curious about goings-on at the hacienda. Even more amazing than this carcass was another mound of trash, which, though smaller than its carted-off predecessor, was deposited in the same exact area where a spit of land jutted out into the river and created in its lee a stagnant, mosquito, and now moose-infested pool. The sight and smell of all this soggy, decomposing trash caused C.B. Whiting to consider the possibility that he had an enemy, and kneeling there on the bank of the river, he scrolled back through his memory concerning the various men he, his father, and his grandfather had managed to ruin in the natural course of business. The list was not short, but unless he'd forgotten someone, no one on it seemed the right sort. They were mostly small men of smaller means, men who might have shot him if the opportunity had presented itself, if, for instance, he'd wandered into their neighborhood tavern when they had a snoot full and happened to be armed. But this was a different quality of maliciousness. Somebody apparently believed that all the trash generated in Dexter County belonged on C.B. Whiting's doorstep and felt sufficient conviction to collect all that garbage, no pleasant task, and transport it there. Was the dead moose a coincidence? C.B. couldn't decide. The animal had a bullet hole in its neck, which could mean any number of things. Perhaps whoever was dumping the trash had also shot the moose and left it there on purpose. Then again, the animal could conceivably have been shot elsewhere by a poacher. In fact, an entire family of poachers, the Minties, lived in Empire Falls. Maybe the wounded animal had attempted to cross the river, tired in the attempt and drowned, coming to rest below the hacienda. C.B. Whiting spent the rest of the afternoon on one knee, only a few feet from the blasted moose, trying to deduce his enemy's identity. Almost immediately, a paper cup floated by and lodged between the hind legs of the moose. The next hour brought a supermarket bag, an empty bobbing Coke bottle, a rusted-out oil can, a huge tangle of monofilament fishing line, and, unless he was mistaken, a human placenta. All of it got tangled up with the reeking moose. From where C.B. Whiting knelt, he could just barely see one small section of the iron bridge, and in the next half hour he witnessed half a dozen people, in automobiles and afoot, toss things into the river as they crossed. In his mind, he counted the number of bridges spanning the knocks upstream, 8, and the number of mills and factories and sundry small businesses that backed onto the water, dozens. He knew firsthand the temptation of dumping into the river after the sun went down. Generations of Whitings had been dumping dyes and other chemicals, staining the riverbank all the way to Fairhaven, a community that could scarcely complain, given that its own textile mill had for decades exhibited an identical lack of regard for its downstream neighbors. Complaints, C.B. knew, inevitably led to accusations. Accusations to publicity, publicity to investigations, investigations to litigation, litigation to expense, expense to the poorhouse. Still, this particular dumping could not be allowed to continue. A sensible man, Charles Beaumont Whiting arrived at a sensible conclusion. At the end of a second hour spent kneeling at the river's edge, he concluded that he had an enemy all right, and it was none other than God himself who designed the dam river in such a way, narrow and swift running upstream, widening and slowing at Empire Falls, that all manner of other people's shit became Charles Beaumont Whiting's. Worse, he imagined he understood why God had chosen this plan. He'd done it in advance to punish him for leaving his best self in Mexico all those years ago, and as a result, becoming somebody who could be mistaken for his father. These were unpleasant thoughts. Perhaps, it occurred to C.B., it was impossible to have pleasant ones so close to a decomposing moose. Yet he continued to kneel there, the river's current burbling a coded message he felt he was on the verge of comprehending. In truth, today's were not the first unpleasant thoughts he'd been visited by of late. Ever since he decided to build the new house, his sleep had been troubled by dreams that would awaken him several times a night, and sometimes he found himself standing at the dark window of his bedroom, looking out over the grounds of the Whiting mansion, with no memory of waking up and crossing the room. He had the distinct impression that the dream, whatever it had been about, was still with him, though its details had fled. Had he been in urgent conversation with someone? Who? During the day, when his mind should have been occupied by the incessant demands of two factories' day-to-day operations, he often and absent-mindedly studied the blueprints of the hacienda, as if he'd forgotten some crucial element. Last month his attention had grown so divided that he'd asked his father to come down from the paper mill to help out one day a week, just until the house was finished. Now, down by the river, his thoughts disturbed, perhaps by the proximity of rotting moose, he began to doubt that building this new house was a good idea. The hacienda, with its adjacent artist studio, was surely an invitation to his former self, the Charles Beaumont Whiting, Bo, his friends had called him there, he'd abandoned in Mexico. And it was this Bo, it now occurred to him, with whom he'd been conversing in all those dreams. Worse, it was for this younger, betrayed self that he was building the hacienda. He'd been telling himself that the studio would be for his son, assuming he would one day be fortunate enough to have one. This much rebellion he'd allowed himself. The studio would be his gift to the boy, an implicit promise that no son of his would ever be forced by necessity or loyalty to betray his truest destiny. But of course he now realized all this was a lie. He'd wanted the studio for himself, or rather for the Charles Beaumont Whiting, thought to be either dead or living a life of poetry and fornication in Mexico. Whereas he, in fact, was living a life of enforced duty and chastity in Empire Falls, Maine. On the heels of this stunning realization came another, the message the river had been whispering to him as he knelt there all afternoon was a single word of invitation. Come, the water burbled, unmistakable now. Come, come, come. That very evening, C.B. Whiting brought his father and old Elijah out to the building site. Up to this point, he'd been secretive about the house without comprehending why. Now he understood. He and Honus sat his grandfather, who hadn't been out of the carriage house in a month, on a tree stump, where he instantly fell into a deep, restful, flatulent sleep, while C.B. showed his father in and around the frames and arches of the new house. Yes, he admitted, it was going to be some damn Mexican sort of deal. The detached structure, he explained, would be a guest house, which in fact he'd decided that afternoon it would be. The river's invitation had scared him that badly. When they finished the tour of the hacienda, C.B. Whiting took his father down to the water's edge and showed him the mound of trash which had grown since morning and the moose which had ripened further. From where they stood, C.B. could see both the moose and old Elijah still asleep, but rising up on one cheek every now and then from the sheer force of his gas. And while C.B. couldn't reasonably hold himself responsible for either, he felt something rise in the back of his throat that tasted like self-loathing. Still, he told himself, the occasional flavor of self-recrimination on the back of the tongue was preferable to throwing away the work of his father's and grandfather's lifetimes, and he found himself regarding both men with genuine fondness, especially his father, whom he had always loved, and whose solid, practical, confident presence could be counted on to deliver him from his present funk. "It's God, all right," Honus agreed, after C.B. had explained his theory about the enemy, and then they watched for a while as various pieces of detritus bobbed along in the current before coming to rest against the moose. The elder Whiting was a religious man who found God useful for explaining anything that was otherwise insoluble. You better figure out what you're gonna do about him, too. Honus suggested his son hire some geologists and engineers to study the problem and recommend a course of action. This turned out to be excellent advice, and the engineers, warned whom they might be up against, proved meticulous. In addition to numerous on-site inspections, they analyzed the entire region on geological survey maps and even flew the length of the river all the way from the Canadian border to where it emptied into the Gulf of Maine. As rivers went, the Knox was one of God's poorer efforts, wide and lazy, where it should have been narrow and swift, and the engineers concurred with the man who'd hired them that it was God's basic design flaw that ensured that every paper cup discarded between the border and Empire Falls would likely wash up on C.B. Whiting's future lawn. That was the bad news. The good news was that it didn't have to be that way. Men of vision had been improving upon God's designs for the better part of two centuries, and there was no reason not to correct this one. If the Army Corps of Engineers could make the damn Mississippi run where they wanted it to, a pissant stream like the Knox could be altered at their whim. In no time, they arrived at a plan. A few miles north and east of Empire Falls, the river took a sharp, unreasonable turn before meandering back in the direction it had come from for several sluggish, twisting miles, much of its volume draining off into swampy lowlands north and west of town where legions of black flies bred each spring, followed by an equal number of mosquitoes in the summer. Seen from the air, the absurdity of this became clear. What water wanted to do, the engineers explained, was flow downhill by the straightest possible route. Meandering was what happened when a river's best intentions were somehow thwarted. What prevented the Knox from running straight and true was a narrow strip of land, of rock, really, referred to by the locals as the Robidoux Blight, an outcropping of rolling, hummocky ground that might have been considered picturesque if your purpose was to build a summer home on the bluff overlooking the river and not to farm it, as the land's owners had been bullheadedly attempting to do for generations. In the end, of course, rivers get their way, and eventually, say in a few thousand years, the Knox would succeed in cutting its way through the meander. C.B. Whiting was disinclined to wait, and he was buoyed to learn from his engineers that if the money could be found to blast a channel through the narrowest part of the Robidoux Blight, the river should be running straight and true within the calendar year, its increased velocity downstream at Whiting's Bend sufficient to bear off the vast majority of trash, including the odd moose, downstream to the dam in Fairhaven, where it belonged. In fact, C.B. Whiting's experts argued before the state in hastily convened closed-door hearings that the Knox would be a far better river, swifter, prettier, cleaner, for all the communities along its banks. Further, with less of its volume being siphoned off into the wetlands, the state would benefit from the acquisition of several thousand acres of land that might be used for purposes other than breeding bugs. No real environmental movement in the state of Maine would exist for decades, so there was little serious opposition to the plan. Though the experts did concede, their voices low and confidential now, that a livelier river might occasionally prove too lively. The Knox, like most rivers in Maine, was already prone to flooding, especially in the spring, when warm rains melted the northern snowpack too quickly. A more practical obstacle to C.B. Whiting's alterations was that the Robidoux Blight had somehow been overlooked when previous generations of Whitings were buying up the river frontage. This parcel was owned by a family named Robidoux, whose title extended back into the previous century. But here, too, fate smiled on C.B. Whiting, for the Robidoux turned out to be both greedy and ignorant, the precise combination called for by the present circumstance. More sophisticated people might have suspected the worth of their holdings when approached by a rich man's lawyers, but the Robidoux apparently did not. Their primary fear seemed to be that C.B. Whiting would actually come inspect the land they were selling him, see how worthless it was for farming, the only use they'd imagine for it, and promptly back out of the deal. Having no such intention, he purchased their acreage at what they imagined to be an extortionary price, and for years afterward they continued to believe they'd one-upped one of the richest and most powerful men in Maine, whose purchase of the Robidoux Blight just went to prove what they'd always known, that rich people weren't so damn smart. C.B. Whiting, himself again after coming out of his funk, came to a conclusion every bit as dubious, that he'd trumped not only the Robidoux, who had him over a barrel and were too ignorant to suspect it, but also God, whose river he would now improve upon. The dynamiting of the Robidoux Blight, some 7 miles upstream, could be felt all the way to Empire Falls. And on the day in August when the blasting was complete, C.B. Whiting knelt on the riverbank before his newly completed house and watched with pride as the freshly energized currents bore off what little remained of the moose, along with the ever-increasing mound of milk cartons, plastic bottles, and rusted soup cans, all bobbing their way south toward an unsuspecting Fairhaven. The river no longer whispered despair as it had earlier in the summer. Re-energized, it fairly chortled with glee at his enterprise. Satisfied with the outcome, he lit a cigar, inhaled deeply of sweet summer air, and regarded the slender woman at his side, whose name, by no coincidence, was Francine Robidoux. Francine was a bright, ambitious young woman, newly graduated from Bowdoin College, some 10 years C.B. Whiting's junior, and until the day her family closed the deal to sell her future husband, the Robidoux Blight, she'd never laid eyes on him, though of course she'd heard of him. C.B. himself had graduated from Bowdoin, as had his father and grandfather, whereas Francine was the first Robidoux to continue her education beyond high school. Thanks to a scholarship, She had emerged from Bowdoin no longer recognizable as a Robideau in deportment, speech, or mannerism, which disturbed and angered her family, who never would have allowed her to attend college had they known how contemptuous of them she'd be upon her return. A poor girl among rich ones, Francine Robideau had carefully observed and then adopted their table manners, fashion sense, vocal idiosyncrasies, and personal hygiene. At Bowdoin, she'd also learned to flirt. In the soft light of his lawyer's book-lined offices, C.B. Whiting, who had not looked seriously at a woman since returning to Maine, liked the look of Francine Robideau. He also appreciated that she was a Bowdoin graduate and admired that she appeared to understand that he was snookering her family and didn't necessarily object. Every time he glanced at her, every time she spoke, he was more impressed. For the girl seemed able to convey, without contradiction, that she was observing him carefully, even as other of her mannerisms suggested that maybe, so far as she was concerned, he wasn't even in the room. Maybe he was there and maybe he wasn't, depending. To resolve the issue of whether he was there or not, he resolved to marry her if she would have him. Well, as it turned out, she would. They were wed in September, leaving C.B. Whiting the rest of his days on Earth to try to remember what exactly it was about the look of Francine Robideau that had so appealed to him in the soft light of the lawyer's offices. In natural light, she looked rather pinched, and in the manner of a great many women of French-Canadian ancestry, she lacked a chin, as if someone had already pinched her there. He also came to understand that marrying Francine Robideau would not answer as conclusively as he'd hoped the question of whether or not he was actually in the room. On that late afternoon in August, when he lit a cigar in celebration, his wife-to-be at his side, C.B. Whiting studied his fiancée carefully. Whiting men, all of whom seemed to be born with sound business sense, each invariably gravitated like moths to a flame toward the one woman in the world who would regard making them utterly miserable as her life's noble endeavor. A woman who would remain bound to her husband with the same grim tenacity that bound nuns to the suffering Christ. Fully cognizant of his family history, C.B. had been understandably wary of matrimony. From time to time, his father would remind him that he would have need of an heir, but then C.B. regarded his father and grandfather and wasn't so sure. Why not put an end to the awful cycle of misery right there? What was the purpose of producing more Whiting males if they were predestined to lives of marital torment? And so C.B. Whiting scrutinized Francine Robideau, trying to envision some future day when he might want to beat her to death with a shovel. Thankfully, he wasn't able to call such a scene into vivid imaginative life. About the best he could do was contemplate the possibility that it had been unwise to go to war with God. If he could deliver unto you an unwanted moose, what was to prevent him from delivering something even worse? Say, for instance, an unwanted woman. This would have been a worrisome contemplation had he not wanted this woman. But he did want her. He was almost sure of it. His bride-to-be had other thoughts. "That would be a fine place for a gazebo, Charlie," she observed, indicating with her thin index finger a spot halfway down the bank. When Charles Beaumont Whiting did not immediately respond, Francine Robideau repeated her observation, and this time her future husband thought he detected a slight edge to her tone. "Did you hear what I said, Charlie?" He had. In truth, though he had no objection to gazebos in general, he was not entirely taken with the idea of erecting one as an architectural companion to a hacienda. This aesthetic reservation was not, however, the cause of his hesitation. No, the reason he hadn't responded was that no one had ever called him Charlie. From boyhood, he had always been Charles, and his mother in particular had been adamant that the fine name she'd given him was not to be corrupted with more common nicknames, like Charlie, or even worse, Chuck. For a brief time in college, his friends had called him Beaumont, and in Mexico, he'd been Bo. More recently, his business acquaintances mostly referred to him as CB, but they did so reverentially and would never have presumed to address him as Charlie. The time to set the record straight was now. But as he considered how best to suggest his preference for Charles over Charlie, he became aware that now had already passed into then. Strange. Had anyone else called him Charlie, he'd have corrected that person before his or her voice had a chance to fall. But for some reason, with this woman, whom he had asked on bended knee to be his bride, he delayed. A beat passed, and then another, and another, until Charles Beaumont Whiting realized that he was mute with a new emotion. At first he noted only its unpleasant sensation, but eventually he identified it. The emotion was fear. "I said," his wife-to-be began a third time. "Yes, dear, an excellent idea," Charles Beaumont Whiting agreed, and in that fateful moment became Charlie Whiting. Later in life, he was fond of remarking, rather ruefully, that he always had the last word in all differences of opinion with his wife, and that, two words actually, was, "Yes, dear." Had he known how many times he would repeat that phrase to this woman, how it would become the mantra of their marriage, he might well have recollected the river's invitation and committed himself to its current then and there and followed the moose downstream, thereby saving himself a great deal of misery and the price of the handgun he would purchase 30 years later for the purpose of ending his life. "And would you mind putting out that awful cigar?" Francine Robidoux added. Part 1. Chapter 1. The Empire Grill was long and low-slung, with windows that ran its entire length. And since the building next door, a Rexall drugstore, had been condemned and razed, it was now possible to sit at the lunch counter and see straight down Empire Avenue all the way to the old textile mill and its adjacent shirt factory. Both had been abandoned now for the better part of 2 decades, though their dark, looming shapes at the foot of the avenue's gentle incline continued to draw the eye. Of course, nothing prevented a person from looking up Empire Avenue in the other direction, but Miles Roby, the proprietor of the restaurant, and its eventual owner, he hoped, had long noted that his customers rarely did. No, their natural preference was to gaze down to where the street both literally and figuratively dead-ended at the mill and factory, the undeniable physical embodiment of the town's past. And it was the magnetic quality of the old abandoned structures that steeled Miles' resolve to sell the Empire Grill for what little it would bring just as soon as the restaurant was his. Just beyond the factory and mill ran the river that long ago had powered them, and Miles often wondered if these old buildings were razed, would the town that had grown up around them be forced to imagine a future? Perhaps not. Nothing but a chain-link fence had gone up in place of the Rexall, which meant, Miles supposed, that diverting one's attention from the past was not the same as envisioning and embarking upon a future. On the other hand, if the past were razed, the slate wiped clean, maybe fewer people would confuse it with the future, and that, at least, would be something. For as long as the mill and factory remained, Miles feared, many would continue to believe against all reason that a buyer might be found for one or both, and that consequently Empire Falls would be restored to its old economic viability. What drew Miles Roby's anxious eye down Empire this particular afternoon in early September was not the dark, high-windowed shirt factory where his mother had spent most of her adult working life, or just beyond it, the larger, brooding presence of the textile mill, but rather his hope that he'd catch a glimpse of his daughter, Tick, when she rounded the corner and began her slow, solitary trek up the avenue. Like most of her high school friends, Tick, a rail-thin sophomore, lugged all her books in a canvas L.L. Bean backpack and had to lean forward, as if into a strong headwind, to balance a weight nearly as great as her own. Oddly, Most of the conventions Miles remembered from high school had been subverted. He and his friends had carried their textbooks balanced on their hips, listing first to the left, then shifting the load and listing to the right. They brought home only the books they would need that night, or the ones they remembered needing, leaving the rest crammed in their lockers. Kids today stuffed the entire contents of their lockers into their seam-stretched backpacks and brought it all home, probably, Miles figured, so they wouldn't have to think through what they'd need and what they could do without, thereby avoiding the kinds of decisions that might trail consequences. Except that this itself had consequences. A visit to the doctor last spring had revealed the beginnings of scoliosis, a slight curvature of Tick's spine, which worried Miles at several levels. "She's just carrying too much weight," the doctor explained, unaware, as far as Miles could tell, of the metaphorical implications of her remark. It had taken Tick most of the summer to regain her normal posture, and yesterday, after one day back at school, she was already hunched over again. Instead of catching sight of his daughter, the one person in the world he wanted at that moment to see rounding the corner, Miles was instead treated to the sight of Walt Como, the person he least wanted to see, the one he could live happily without ever laying eyes on again, pulling into a vacant parking space in front of the Empire Grill. Walt's van was rolling advertisement for its driver, who'd had the Silver Fox stenciled across the hood just above the grill, and its vanity plates read, Foxy One. The van was tall and Walt short, which meant he had to hop down from the running board, and something about the man's youthful bounce made Miles, who'd seen this both in real life and in his dreams just about every day for the past year, want to grab an axe handle, meet the Silver Fox at the door, and stave his head in right there in the entryway. Instead, he turned back to the grill and flipped Horace Weymouth's burger, wondering if he'd already left it on too long. Horace liked his burgers bloody. "So," Horace closed and folded his Boston Globe in anticipation of being fed, his inner clock apparently confirming that Miles had indeed waited too long. "You been out to see Mrs. Whiting yet?" "Not yet," Miles said. He set up Horace's platter with tomato, lettuce, a slice of Bermuda onion, and a pickle, plus the open-faced bun, then pressed down on the burger with his spatula, making it sizzle before slipping it onto the bun. "I usually wait to be summoned."
"I wouldn't," Horace counseled. "Somebody's got to inherit Empire Falls. It might as well be Miles Roby."
"I'd have a better chance of winning the Megabucks lottery," Miles said, sliding the platter onto the counter and noticing, which he hadn't for a long time, the purple fibroid cyst that grew out of Horace's forehead. Had it gotten larger, or was it just that Miles had been away and was seeing it afresh after even a short absence? The cyst had taken over half of Horace's right eyebrow, where hairless skin stretched tight and shiny over the knot, its web of veins fanning outward from its dark center. One of the good things about small towns, Miles' mother had always maintained, was that they accommodated just about everyone. The lame and the disfigured were all your neighbors, and seeing them every day meant that after a while you stopped noticing what made them different. Miles hadn't seen much in the way of physical oddity on Martha's Vineyard, where he and his daughter had vacationed last week. Almost everyone on the island appeared to be rich, slender, and beautiful. When he'd remarked on this, his old friend Peter said that he should come live in L.A. for a while. There, he argued, ugliness was rapidly and systematically being bred out of the species. "He doesn't really mean L.A., Peter's wife Dawn had corrected when Miles appeared dubious. "He means Beverly Hills."
"And Bel Air," Peter added.
"And Malibu," Dawn said. And then they named a baker's dozen other places where unattractiveness had been eradicated. Peter and Dawn were full of such worldly wisdom, which for the most part Miles enjoyed. The three had been undergraduates together at a small Catholic college outside of Portland, and he admired that they were barely recognizable as the students he'd known. Peter and Dawn had become other people entirely, and Miles concluded that this was what was supposed to happen, though it hadn't happened to him. If disappointed by their old friend's lack of personal evolution, they conceal that disappointment well, even going so far as to claim that he restored their faith in humanity by remaining the same old Miles. Since they apparently meant this as a compliment, Miles tried hard to take it that way. They did seem genuinely glad to see him every August, and even though each year he half expected his old friends not to renew the invitation for the following summer, he was always wrong. Horace picked the thin slice of Bermuda off the plate with his thumb and forefinger, as if to suggest great offense at the idea that onion should be in such close proximity to anything he was expected to eat.
"I don't eat onions, Miles. I know you've been away, but I haven't changed. I read the Globe, I write for the Empire Gazette, I never send Christmas cards, and I don't eat onions."
Miles accepted the onion slice and deposited it in the garbage. It was true he'd been slightly off all day, still sluggish and stupid from vacation, forgetting things that were second nature. He'd intended to work himself back in gradually by supervising the first couple shifts, but Buster, with whom Miles alternated at the grill, always took his revenge by going on a bender as soon as Miles returned from the island, forcing him back behind the grill before he was ready.
"She's better than Megabucks," Horace said,
still on the subject of Mrs. Whiting, who each year spent less and less time in Maine, wintering in Florida, and doing what Miles's long-dead Irish maternal grandmother, who liked to stay put, would have called gallivanting. Apparently, Mrs. Whiting had just returned from an Alaskan cruise.
"If I was a member of the family, I'd be out there kissing her bony ass every day."
Miles watched Horace assemble his burger, relieved to see a red stain spreading over the bun. Miles Roby was not, of course, a member of Mrs. Whiting's family. What Horace referred to was the fact that the old woman's maiden name had been Robidoux, and some maintained that the Robys and the Robidoux of Dexter County were, if you went back far enough, the same family. Miles' own father, Max, believed this to be true, though for him it was purely a matter of wishful thinking. Lacking any evidence that he and the richest woman in central Maine weren't related, Max decided they must be. Miles knew that if his father had been the one with the money and somebody named Robidoux felt entitled to even a dime of it, he naturally would have seen the whole thing differently. Of course, it was a moot point. Mrs. Whiting had married all that money in the person of C.B. Whiting, who had owned the paper mill and the shirt factory and the textile mill before selling them all to multinational corporations so they could be pillaged and then closed. The Whiting family still owned half the real estate in Empire Falls, including the grill, which Miles had managed for Mrs. Whiting these last 15 years, with the understanding that the business would devolve upon him at her passing, an event Miles continued to anticipate without somehow being able to imagine it. What would happen to the rest of the old woman's estate was a matter of great speculation. Normally, it would have been inherited by her daughter, but Cindy Whiting had been in and out of the state mental hospital in Augusta all her adult life, and it was widely believed that Mrs. Whiting would never entrust her daughter with anything more than her continued maintenance required. In truth, no one in Dexter County knew much about Mrs. Whiting's actual wealth or her plans for it. She never dealt with local lawyers or accountants, preferring to employ a Boston firm that the Whitings had used for nearly a century. She did little to discourage the notion that a significant legacy would one day go to the town itself, but neither did she offer any concrete assurances. Mrs. Whiting was not known for philanthropy. In times of crisis, such as the most recent flood of the Knox River, she occasionally contributed, though she always insisted that the community match her donation. Similar restrictions were applied to seed money for a new wing of the hospital and a grant to upgrade computers at the high school. Such gifts, though sizable, were judged to be little more than shavings off the tip of a financial iceberg. When the woman was dead, it was hoped, the money would flow more freely. Miles wasn't so sure. Mrs. Whiting's generosity toward the town, like that she extended to him, was puzzlingly ambiguous. Some years ago, for instance, she donated the decaying old Whiting Mansion, which occupied a large section of the downtown, with the proviso that it be preserved. It was only after accepting her gift that the mayor and town council came to understand the extent of the burden they'd been handed. They could no longer collect taxes on the property, which they were not permitted to use for social events, and maintenance costs were considerable. Similarly, if Mrs. Whiting did end up giving the restaurant to Miles, he feared that the gift would be too costly to accept. In fact, now that the mills were all closed down, it sometimes appeared that Mrs. Whiting had cornered the market on business failure. She owned most of the commercial space in town and was all too happy to help new enterprises start up in one of her buildings. But then rents had a way of going up, and none of the businesses seemed to get anywhere, nor did their owners when they appealed to Mrs. Whiting for more favorable terms.
"I don't know, Miles," Horace said. "You seem to have a special place in that old woman's heart. Her treatment of you is unique, in my experience. The fact that she hasn't closed the grill down suggests just how deep her affection runs. Either that, or she enjoys watching you suffer."
Though Miles understood this last observation to be a joke, he found himself, and not for the first time, considering whether it might not be the simple, literal truth. Viewed objectively, Mrs. Whiting did appear to cut him more slack than was her custom, and yet there were times when Miles got the distinct impression that she bore him no particular fondness, which probably explained why he was not all that eager to meet with her now, though he knew their annual meeting could not be postponed for long. Each autumn she left for Florida earlier than the last, and while their annual State of the Grill meetings were little more than a pro forma ritual, Mrs. Whiting refused to forego them. And in her company he could not shake the feeling that for all these years the old woman had been expecting him to show her some sign, of what he had no idea. Still, he left every encounter with the sense that he'd yet again failed some secret test. The bell jingled above the door, and Walt Como danced inside, his arms extended like an old-fashioned crooner's, his silver hair slicked back on the sides, 50s style.
"Don't let the stars get in your eyes," he warbled. "Don't let the moon break your heart."
Several of the regulars at the lunch counter, knowing what was expected of them, swiveled on their stools, leaned into the aisle, right arms extended in a row and returned in a different key altogether.
Pa-pa-pa-pa-ya.
"Perry Como," Horace said when he realized, without actually looking, that the seat next to him at the counter had been filled. "Right on time."
"Big boy," Walt said, addressing Miles. "You hear the news?"
"Oh, please," said Miles, who'd been hearing little else all morning. Over the weekend, a black Lincoln town car with Massachusetts plates had been reported in the lot outside the textile mill. Last year, it had been a BMW. The year before that, a Cadillac limo. The color of the vehicle seemed to alternate between black and white, but the plates were always Massachusetts, which made Miles smile. The hordes of visitors who poured into Maine every summer were commonly referred to as massholes, and yet when Empire Falls fantasized about deliverance, it invariably had Massachusetts plates.
"What?" Walt said indignant. "You weren't even there."
"Let him tell you about it," Horace advised. "Then it'll be over."
Walt Como looked back and forth between Miles and Horace as if to determine who was the bigger fool, settling finally on Horace, probably because he'd spoken last.
"All right, you explain it. Three guys in $800 suits drive all the way up here from Boston on a Sunday morning, park outside the mill, hike down to the head of the falls in their black patent leather shoes, then stand there for half an hour pointing up at the mill. You tell me who they are and what they're doing."
Horace set his hamburger down and wiped his mouth with his napkin.
"Hey, it's clear to me. They came to invest millions. For a while, they were thinking about tech stocks. But then they thought, hell no, let's go into textiles. That's where the real profits are.
Then you know what they did? They decided not to build a factory in Mexico or Thailand where people work for about $10 a week. Let's drive up to Empire Falls, Maine, they said, and look at that gutted old shell of a factory that the river damn near washed away last spring, and buy all new equipment and create hundreds of jobs, nothing under $20 an hour.
Miles couldn't help smiling. Minus the sarcasm, this was pretty much the scenario he'd been listening to all morning. The annual sighting was born, as far as Miles could tell, of the same need that caused people to spot Elvis in the local Denny's. But why always autumn? Miles wondered. It seemed an odd season to spawn such desperate optimism. Maybe it had something to do with the kids all going back to school, giving their parents the leisure to contemplate the approach of another savage, relentless winter, and to conjure up a pipe dream to help them through it.
"Hey," Walt said, sounding hurt, "all I'm saying is something nice could happen here someday. You never know. That's all I'm saying, okay?"
Horace had gone back to his hamburger, and this time he didn't bother to put it down or wipe his mouth before speaking.
"Something nice," he repeated. "Is that what you think? That having money makes people nice?"
"Ah, to hell with you," Walt said, dismissing both men with a single wave of his hand. "Here's what I'd like to know, though, smartass. How can you sit here and eat one greasy hamburger after another, day after goddamn day? Don't you have any idea how bad that junk is for you?"
Horace, who had one bite of burger left, put it on his plate and looked up.
"What I don't know is why you have to ruin my lunch every day. Why can't you leave people in peace?"
"Because I care about you," Walt said. "I can't help it."
"I wish you could," Horace said, pushing his platter away.
"Well, I can't."
Walt pushed Horace's platter even farther down the counter and took a worn deck of cards out of his pocket, slapping it down in front of Horace. "I can't let you die before I figure out how you're beating me at gin." Horace polished some hamburger grease into the countertop with his napkin before cutting the deck.
"You should live so long. Hell, I should live so long," he said, watching the deal, content to wait until he had his whole hand before picking up any cards.
He always gave the impression of having played all these hands before, as if the chief difficulty presented by each one was the boredom inherent in pretending over and over again that you didn't know how everything would eventually play out. By contrast, when Horace dealt, Walt picked up each card on the fly, identifying it eagerly, each hand promising an entirely new experience.
"Nope," he now said, arranging the cards in his hand one way, then another, uncertain as to which organizing principle, suits or numbers, would be more likely to guarantee victory. "I'm your best friend, Horace. You just don't know it. And I'll tell you something else you don't know. You don't know who your worst enemy is, either."
Horace, who seldom seemed to move more than a card or two before his hand made sense, rolled his eyes at Miles.
"Who might that be, Perry?" Horace asked, the way a man will when he already knows what's coming. It wasn't just these gin hands he'd played before.
Walt nodded at Miles. "It's Big Boy here," he said, to no one's surprise.
"You keep eating his greasy burgers, you're gonna look just like him, too, if you don't have a coronary first."
"You want some coffee, Walt?" Miles asked. "I always feel better about you undermining my business after I've coaxed 85 cents out of you."
"You need more customers like me," Walt replied, tossing a 20 on the counter.
Among the many things Miles held against the Silver Fox was his compulsion to break large bills at every opportunity. Even if his wallet was full of singles, he always paid for his coffee with a 20 or a 50. Occasionally, he tried to get Miles to break 100, enjoying the sport of Miles' refusal.
"A cup of coffee cost you, what, a dime, 15 cents? And you get almost a buck for it, right? That's 85 cents profit. Not too shabby."
Miles poured each man a cup, then took Walt's 20 to the register. There was no point calling the Silver Fox on the intentional vagaries of his arithmetic. After I refill it 4 or 5 times, how much have I made then? When the bell over the door jingled again, Miles glanced up and saw his younger brother enter, a newspaper tucked under his ruined arm. Noting where Walt Como was seated, he located a stool at the other end of the counter. When Miles poured him a cup of coffee, David, who had already unfolded the front section and begun reading, met his eye and glanced down the counter at Walt Como before returning to his paper. For the most part, the brothers understood each other perfectly, especially their silences. This one suggested that in David's view, Miles had not returned from his vacation any smarter than he was before he left.
"You're pretty well prepped," Miles said, referring to the private party David was catering that evening. "I brought you back a couple jars of that lobster paste for bisque."
David nodded, pouring milk into his coffee with his good hand.
"Tell me something," he said. "Why do you allow him in here?"
"It's against the law to refuse service."
"So's murder," David said, picking up the newspaper again. "It'd be an elegant solution just the same."
Miles tried to imagine it. Assuming he could get hold of a handgun, what kind of man, he wondered, would walk up to another human being, even Walt Como, and squeeze another death into the world? Not Miles Roby, concluded Miles Roby.
"Hey," his brother said, when Miles started back down the counter. "Thanks for the paste. How is the vineyard?"
"I think Peter and Dawn might be calling it quits," Miles told him. David didn't look very surprised, or interested for that matter. The idea of old college friends seemed to bore him, perhaps because David himself had never gone beyond high school, except for a single semester at the Maine Culinary Institute.
"I could be wrong," Miles continued. He hated the idea of Peter and Dawn divorcing, which, if true, would take some getting used to. In fact, he still wasn't used to the idea of his own divorce. It was just an impression.
"You didn't answer my question," David observed, without looking up from the paper. Miles tried to remember. Had there been a question? More than one?
"How was the vineyard?"
"Oh, right," Miles said, aware that this was precisely the sort of thing his soon-to-be ex-wife always complained of, that he never really listened to her. For 20 years, he tried to convince Janine that this wasn't the case, or at least wasn't precisely the case. It wasn't that he didn't hear her questions and requests. It was more that they always provoked a response she hadn't anticipated. "I'm not ignoring you," he insisted, to which she invariably replied, "You might as well be."
"Well," his brother wanted to know, "about the vineyard?"
"Just the same," Miles told him. Of all the places in the world he couldn't hope to afford, the vineyard was his favorite.
"You know what you need in here, big boy?" Walt called from